Thank you for being here. We're in Hebrews chapter 11, looking at the life of Abraham. We're in Genesis chapter 20 as we kind of review it. We've kind of taken a side path here, and we're kind of plowing through some details in the life of Abraham that the book of Hebrews really doesn't address, but since we're there, I thought we'd just kind of continue. We're looking, kind of trying to get to in chapter 22, where you're going to see Abraham offer Isaac. So we're heading towards chapter 22, but we're in chapter 20 of Genesis. If you look at your map right here, just the notes that you've got, we're going to see Abram is starting off today in chapter 20. We've had in chapter 18, the Lord had come down and visited Abram near the great trees of Mamre near Hebron. And that's where two angels came with him. They appeared as three men. They ate a meal with him. Abraham and Sarah got everything ready. They announce that Sarah is going to have a child in about a year. That was chapter 18. And then at the end of chapter 18 into chapter 19, that's where the angels go down to Sodom. That's where Abram and the Lord stay and talk, and the Lord negotiates with Abram. Very interesting, and you're going to see it very clearly today in chapter 20. And that's this chapter 20 is... You just read through it, and it just seems like just a little bit of detail that's not real important. But there are some things in there that give you kind of a glimpse into how God viewed Abraham and what Abraham's role was. But the very fact that you see in chapter 18 and 19, there Abraham and the Lord talking, and there you've got Abram talking with the Lord about how many people will be needed for Sodom to be spared. And it's almost like the Lord is, or Abraham is negotiating with the Lord, and the Lord is responding. Even says, I should tell Abraham what I'm going to do, because he's going to become a great nation, and he should know these things. So in the scope of the Lord's interaction in history, Abraham is important. He's just not a tool that is being used, but he's something that is important by the Lord, and he takes Abraham's view and his position and his words into consideration. And we'll see that more today. But nonetheless, that's in the land of or the city of Hebron. He's living there. On the map, you can see he's going to travel today down towards the Negev, which is in southern Israel. It's the wilderness area. Here's the Mediterranean. Here we'll just put the Dead Sea coming, or the Jordan River, the Dead Sea right here. Here's Salem right in here. Here's Hebron. This is the land of the Philistines. And again, we talk about the Philistines. There are Philistines. They're in the story today. But the Philistines of this time period of 2000 BC, we've said this before, are not the same as the Philistines of 1000 BC. They're in the same place, the similar culture, but in 2000 BC, they were a type of a Semitic people. Sometime around 1200 BC, you're going to have the invasion of the Sea People, which is documented on the walls of the Egyptians fighting the Sea People. They came down over here. They destroyed the city of Ugarit. We've got a lot of manuscripts or cuneiform tablets from there. We'll refer to that many times. But they were Greeks, and they then married into with this Semitic group of the Philistines. And archaeology today has shown the bones of the Philistines have Greek DNA in them. In fact, they found Greek homes. They found infants that were fully Greek, not even intermarried with the Semitics. So there's going to be a transition here. So when David meets Goliath in 1000 BC, he's meeting someone that's an influence by Greek culture. In fact, he's fighting. Goliath is doing a hero battle where each side presents their hero. And that comes right out of the Greek culture. And it pops up in the life of David, where David steps up and is Israel's hero and goes one-on-one with the champion from the Philistines. That was the Greek influence on the Philistines. When we say Philistines, don't think 1000 BC Philistines. We're still in 2000 BC where you've got Semitic people. Anyway, Abram's going today is going to leave Hebron and go down into the Negev. The Negev is this desert, dry area. There's a place, there's some, you know, grass growing, you know, in between all the rocks, and there's a place where you can pasture your cattle, your sheep. There's also going to be an oasis is going to pop up. He's going to be in an oasis, and he's going to end up coming up and crossing into the land of the Philistines today and meeting with Abimelech, whose name means my father is king. And you're going to, and he's the king of the Philistines. And in David's day, David's also going to have a friendship with the king of the Philistines, whose name is, in 1000 BC, Abimelech, which means my father is king, which is a great name for a prince who's going to become the king. And so that's why sometimes they get, what, is this guy still alive? Well, they just keep, it's like a family name, or just keeps being handed down, per se. So that's kind of the stage right here. He's going to end up leaving the land of the Philistines and heading to a place called Beersheba. And we'll talk about that next week. Beers, I wrote beers on there, abbreviated. But if you turn the page over, I've been wanting to show you this since, you know, 2 weeks ago. There is Beersheba today. He's going to have a well there. You can see on the map, I've got a little place where it's got the Abraham's well. And that well is going to come up. That is outside the gates of Beersheba today. And again, it's probably the same well. It's probably got some new blocks around it. But when you dig a well, of course, you dig a tunnel down into the water source. And once it's there, it's just maintained. So this is probably the well that Abraham dug. And if it's not the well, it's very, very close to. And why would you dig another, you know, shaft down if there's already a shaft there that you're maintaining? And so once that well was dug, it was probably maintained throughout the years. So anyway, that's called the Well of Abraham, and that's actually there in Beersheba. We got a picture of some camels outside Beersheba as we're driving in. You can see camels wandering around. And you are in the Negev. You can kind of see a little bit in that picture what the weather or the topography looks like. The picture right here in the middle, that's the tell of Beersheba. A lot of structures have been excavated. There's storerooms, there's houses, there's a variety of things that have been excavated from this time period, including the city walls. And that's from a distance. You can see kind of the well there at the top of the tell. And then the very bottom picture, you can see the well at the bottom left, kind of that water trough coming off the well. And that's the city gate going into the city of Beersheba. The original rocks, you can see towards the bottom of the wall, and then the bricks are reconstructed. So there's a line there that's original, and then they just kind of built up to kind of give you a feel for what it would have looked like. So that's what's being done there. You can see that in the first, very first picture, too, the original block wall with some bricks on top, and that's the reconstruction to kind of give it a feel. But anyway, that's Beersheba. And that's kind of where we're at in our story. He is leaving Hebron, going down into the Negev, going to land in the land of Philistines, and then leave there to Beersheba. Now, here we go, chapter 20, life of Abraham. And again, if you look in your Bibles, you can see there, chapter 19 is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which probably, if we're going to talk about stuff, that would be a very good thing to discuss today. But, I mean, you see God's behavior, God's patience, waiting until it got so far, and you can see the culture there in the city of Sodom is basically has a mob mentality, beating on someone's door, sexually driven, a perverted form of sexuality, and the chaos is just enormous. Again, just in passing, that is being excavated today, this location. There's scientifically, it was destroyed with tremendous heat, some kind of an atmospheric burst, like a meteor or something coming in that got so hot that just exploded and blew up water from the Dead Sea, covered it up, melted things. There's glass and that has been baked at a tremendous temperatures. Clay and rocks and things were scorched with an enormous temperature. Like I said before, they found things scattered up in the same direction, up against, smashed against the walls of the rooms. Everything smashed over to one side. Consistently throughout the city at this level, including human bones that were just crushed against the wall. And that they're excavating that now. And hopefully there's already been a couple publications, but hopefully it's going to be a little more mainstream. And they're working on it right now. But nonetheless, chapter 20 follows that story. Chapter 20, verse 1. Now, Abraham moved on from there, meaning Hebron. into the region of the Negev, meaning the wilderness down south, into the region of the Negev, and lived between Kadesh and Shur. Now, Kadesh, and I've got it cut off the map right there. Kadesh would be when they came up out of the Exodus out of Egypt, they stayed in Kadesh Barnea. It's right in this area. It's about 50 miles south. The Kadesh is about 50 miles south of Beersheba. And Shur, which is somewhere, there's a location right here. It used to be, there's a wall built here around 2000 BC that is referred to, and they've located it. It's a little bit further south than they thought. But there's a wall there built by, going more like this way, built by the Egyptians to keep the people, the Semitic people, from coming down into Egypt. Anyway, that's Shur, is right around that area. So between Kadesh and Shur is where Abraham is staying. Again, we're just being given his journeys and where he's staying. For a while he stayed in Gerar. So when he went into Kadesh, down in the wilderness area here, towards Shur, where the Egyptian border is, he ends up in a city called Gerar. Now Gerar is about 15 miles west, northwest of Beersheba. So if we would take this right here, my map's off a little bit. He's going to be in Philistine territory. It's about west or northwest of here would be Beersheba, if we're getting a little bit closer. And that is in the land of Philistine. Gerar is a city. It's on the road from Beersheba to Gaza, the city of Gaza, which is very clearly identified, not referred to in this story, but the city of Gerar is on that main road. And there Abram said of his wife Sarah. Now he is entering in the territory. Remember, we know he's got some relationship with Melchizedek, the king of Salem, has no relationship with King Bera of Sodom. In Hebron, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner. He's got some kind of treaty relationship with these people. He's gone down. He's already gone into Egypt. Remember? He says his wife was his sister. And the Pharaoh feared God and sent him back with a bunch of gifts. Well, now, this is a border. He doesn't want to go here. But he crosses into the land of the Philistines, into Gerar. Now he's in Philistine territory, and he's going to interact. He's going to meet Abimelech, the king. But he says when he enters the land, and now just understand, we're not sure exactly why this is necessary. I like to say, Sarah was a beautiful woman, which the Bible records that. And you see her being taken into Pharaoh's harem, and you're going to see her being taken into Abimelech's house here also. And she's 100 years old. Well, 90 years old. You don't just go around and pick up 90-year-old women and bring them into your harem. I mean, that's just not. So, I mean, there's something going on here. Abraham is afraid for his life. If he enters into Egypt and brings his wife along, and he says, she's my sister, we can negotiate. Now, no one knows for sure exactly why. They've tried to make some connections, and I've looked at some studies. They all kind of fall short. One thing we've got to admit here in this story is we do not know clearly what's going on here, why it is such a disadvantage to enter. Again, this is not just Abraham, a guy with a camel and a sister, quote, on a camel walking into a nation. This is a sheik coming in with people. He's got a standing military. He's got cattle. He's got all the money he needs. He's just kind of roaming around, finding room for his cattle and for his people. And then somewhere in the whole conglomeration of things is this woman who is his wife. So if he comes in with a wife, he's almost potentially moving in as a full system. I mean, he's got no needs. He's not willing to negotiate. He's here just to take over. Now, this is speculation. But if he comes across the border with no wife, but I do have a sister, Now all of a sudden, well, brother, I see you've got a lot of stuff, powerful individual. I also have a sister. We could maybe make some kind of covenant like Melchizedek or Aner and Eshcol. Now he's in Egypt. And, well, hey, she may be beautiful, but she may also be, hey, I'll take her in and maybe we can negotiate. And the idea is we can blend our resources together. This is exactly what Jacob does with Sechem later on in the book of Genesis. And so if he says, she's my wife, we have no room for you. You're a unit moving together, a closed unit. If he's available for marriage, there's room for someone to kind of get into the action in his business deal. That's one speculation. The other speculation is she's so ravishingly beautiful that everyone's going to try to kill him so they can marry her. And you can go with that, but there's other beautiful women around, other beautiful 90-year-old women around. I think they'd be more interested in his property and being able to make a contract with him than killing him and stealing his wife, especially if you're the Pharaoh or if you're the king of the Philistines. I'm sure you can find beautiful women around. I think they're looking at the ability for the contract. So when he comes across into Egypt, or in this case, comes across into the Philistines, he says to everyone, oh, that's my sister. Oh, well, then we need to negotiate. What would you like? And we can. And so whatever reason he's there in the land of the Philistines, it's not the promised land. I mean, it's part of the overall promised land, but that he doesn't need to take it or anything. So he's gone here for some reason, not planning on staying, but just kind of moving around, trying to, you know, take care of his crops, take care of his people, with the full intention of eventually leaving. Because he went to Egypt because of the famine, and then he came back. Maybe it's some kind of, it doesn't say famine, but he comes into the land of Philistines. So maybe what he's going to do is he'll be able to negotiate, be called to a lot of dinner meetings, dinner parties, you know, guests at everyone's resorts, you know. It's like, hey, Abraham, and there everybody's negotiating, whining and dining him, hoping to get some kind of action, and he can drive a hard deal, and then when it's time to take off, well, hey, I got to go and move. And all he did was kind of put a front up of being this open businessman looking for some contracts, and when it's time to go, take his wife, and let's get out of town. So you play my sister, they'll negotiate for you, they'll try to get me to find a wife, and we'll just play that game until we're done. Again, potentially. But anyway, we don't know for sure, but here it is. He goes into, for a while, he stayed in Gerar, and there Abram said to his wife Sarah, she is my sister. Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. Now, this would not necessarily, I mean, this is not like an aggressive, the troops bang on the door, give me your wife or your sister. It's like, oh, hey, he's out, you know, his first dinner party. It's like, so, what are you here for? Well, we're just looking for some business deals, you know. It's like, so, are you married? Oh, no, this is my my sister, Sarah. It's like, well, we'd like to, and it's the king finds out, royalty, it's like, we need to make a deal. That's how powerful Abraham is financially. It's like, we'll take her in and we'll start negotiating our contracts right now. So she's taken in. He's not going to touch her. It's going to be very clear he does not touch her, which means he probably takes her off the market, gets her into his set, so no one else can make a deal with Abraham. I've got his sister, probably well taken care of, protected. He's going to make a very clear deal, and he's going to say, I have a clear conscience, because God is going to appear to him. God is going to have to come and say, Abimelech, Abraham has not told you the full story, and Abraham is working for me, and I've got a plan in action here. If you violate this woman, you're all dead. This whole thing is coming down because I cannot let this thing cross line. Because we're in that year, the Lord has already appeared and says within a year, Sarah's going to have a son. So Abraham takes off, goes down to Beersheba, goes in the land of Philistine and says, hey, it's my sister. And now the mother of the promised child is in the harem of Abimelech, probably being protected behind closed doors until this negotiation process is over, and the Lord is going to appear here and explain to Abimelech, yeah, don't mess with this plan. Now, again, what is Abraham thinking? I mean, it's not like he needs money. It's not like he needs more sheep and cattle. He needs more servants. He's already got contracts. I mean, again, I'm asking questions. I don't have the answers. And here's the thing, you're in this balance right here of just reading the Bible story or rushing over like you're some little Christian in a Christian church. We've got to make Abraham look perfect. It's like, well, wait a minute. There's nobody perfect in the Bible. Jesus. But everybody else is a human that when you start telling the story day by day, they are in need of a Savior and are under grace. There's no heroes. Oh, David was a hero. He killed Goliath, but he also killed Uriah, his friend, one of his generals. You got Abraham, who's a man of faith, but he's also going to do a variety of things. It's kind of like, so understand, we don't need to protect Abraham's character, especially if the Bible is telling you the story. Now, we're not going to trash Abraham because maybe this is just the way they do business. Maybe this is, I mean, the guy's got, he made a bunch, he left Ur with an estate, builds his estate while he's in Haran, comes down, makes the negotiation all the way through the land of Israel, and then crosses into Egypt, talks about his wife, and he leaves Egypt with even more stuff and continue. He's just plundered the four kings of the east and brought all the stuff and all the people back, gives it all away. God gives him more additional parts of the promise or details. And now he's down here. Now he's in the land of the Philistines. Now you're going to watch what happens here. I mean, how much money and gold and silver does Abram have? So he's a power player. There's no doubt he's a power, maybe the most powerful individual moving around in this part of the world at this time. It's just, it's like, well, God finds Abraham just a wanderer through the wilderness. It's like, my gosh, he chose one of the most powerful business-minded sheiks. It's like choosing Elon Musk, you know? It's like, he chooses the weak. It's like, he chose Abram. I mean, you get this Christian Sunday school idea, Abraham was a man of God and walked with God and was just a humble man. It's like, well, wait a minute. He's constantly manipulating and lying, making contracts and treaties. He's a power player before God calls him, and God just continues to prosper him. Now, we're not trying to trash him. He's just one of us. Well, okay, he's not one of us. I got to go to work. But nonetheless, we'll talk. But anyway, that's just a story. I mean, just kind of let the Bible text speak to you, and including me. Don't let me, railroad this one way or the other. But he comes in for some reason, makes the announcement at the first dinner party he's at that, yeah, I'm open for negotiations, apparently. This is not my wife. This is my sister. And so Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah, meaning we'd like to invite her in. I don't think banging on the door, give me your sister. It's like sent for her, the limo, the red carpet, the treatment, all the little girls fanning her into the car because we're going to put you aside and we're going to begin negotiating. It's kind of like I'm making a down payment right here. We'll take you over here. And me and Abraham are going to spend the next few weeks kind of negotiating and you can become part of my family. I think that's probably what's happening. He takes her, not, wraps her around, drags her out by the hair, probably picked her up in, the limo of chariots at that time. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, now this is God, it is the word Elohim. Notice it's not Yahweh, it's Elohim. And now we got to be careful right here because what does Abimelech know about Elohim or Yahweh? Because there is, of course, there is the gods. El is the god of the Canaanites, the Ugaritics, all the way, there's a god named El, there's a whole pantheon, and there's little gods underneath them. And so they fear the gods, they fear their god. So keep that in mind. It's kind of like we were talking on Tuesday nights about Cyrus, in the book of Ezra, the Lord commanded him to do certain things. But when you read the Cyrus cylinder, he's talking about Marduk and other gods that he's trying to please, and the Jews kind of probably, they got their form of a letter with their god's name on it, just like other people got their form of the Cyrus cylinder with those cultural names on it. So just kind of, this is Elohim in the text. Watch Abimelech. He fears the god and Elohim. I mean, we know this is Yahweh speaking to him in a dream, but here it is. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, you are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman. And, you know, there's the Lord right there showing patience, but kind of laying it on the table. You've taken a married woman. Now, again, obviously taking a married woman would be wrong. It would be sinful. And that's definitely layer number one. But I think as we go through the story, layer number two, three, as you move up, this is Sarah, who may be pregnant with Isaac already. We've got about a year here the story's taking place, so I'm not sure when that all takes place. But she's going to give birth to Isaac here in a few months, at least within the year. So this is again a married woman, but this is also the mother of the nation of Israel. And so this is on, does God intervene every time a married woman is taken and give the man a dream? I mean, you could go down that road and God warns you, conscience and all that kind of stuff. But this seems to be a little particular aggressive dream. You're a dead man and everyone in your house is dead if you don't give her back. And Abimelech, does that make sense? You are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is married, a married woman. Now Abimelech had not gone near her, okay? Because I don't know why he hadn't gone near. Hadn't got time, busy with the other women. I don't know. I'm going to throw in there, they're still negotiating. She's not fully married. I don't know that. They're still negotiating. I'm throwing that into the story. Understand the difference between what the text says and what I'm saying or adding into it. So he said, Lord. Now that is not all capital letters. See, L-O-R-D. That's not Yahweh. That's Adonai, master. So he calls Elohim master. He recognizes him as God. Will you destroy an innocent nation? Now when he says, you are as good as a dead man, he realizes he's not just talking to me. He's going to wipe out my nation. Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Meaning, I'm in the middle of negotiations. I have not taken her for an impure motive or impure reason or haven't drug her off, you know, in cuffs or something. Did he not say to me, she is my sister? And why would you enter a foreign country talking, looking like a businessman and then say, here's my sister? Because what you're doing is you're saying, here's the doorway into my corporation. You want a contract? And that daughters, sisters were constantly exchanged, not as cattle, although you could go that way if you want to, but that's how they would intermarry. That families, they would find strength in marrying together. So when he says she's my sister, he's putting the deal on the I have an open contract. I have a sister. Did he not say to me, she is my sister? And didn't she also say, he is my brother? So now you got that idea. Oh, poor Sarah. Yeah, there's poor Sarah. But she didn't say, Abraham, would you stop saying that? When she is asked, it's like, oh, would you like to come? It's like, well, sure, I'm his sister. Sure, I'll get in the chariot and ride off with all the luxuries, or however that happened. Again, I'm adding to the story. Did he not say she is my sister, and did she not say he is my brother? I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands. He says, I have not done anything. I'm taking them at their word. They both told me I haven't touched her. I haven't had any bad thoughts. I'm in the middle of a business negotiation or something. But he says, I've got it with a clear conscience. And God doesn't say, you liar, you're trying to, you know, he says this. He says, then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience, and so I have kept you from sinning against me. Now, what has happened? Now, you're going to find out as the story ends, there has been some kind of problem in the house of Abimelech with the women getting pregnant, and then you could go down the whole sexual trail of why are they not getting pregnant and what kind of, you know, problems has Abimelech been having, and it's like, what's happening here? We could explore that if you would like, but understand, God is now taking credit for stopping him from going any further than he should have. Is it slowing down the business deal? Is it everybody got, you know, COVID? I don't know. But God is saying, I know you're innocent, so I've kept you from sinning against not Sarah, not Abraham, but against me. God, again, please hear what I'm saying. God is interested in Abraham. He's interested in Sarah. He's even interested in Abimelech. He's interested in the Philistine nation. But in this verse, who's he interested in? Me. He's interested in the Lord himself, because I'm working a plan here. And you violate this, you're coming against me, and I'm going to stop you because you will not do this. So a lot of times when you see in the Bible, I mean, we like to think of God as being on our side and concerned, loves the world. But even when Joshua came, we've said it 1,000 times, Joshua comes to him outside, or he's outside the city of Jericho getting ready for the invasion, and the angel of the Lord appears, and Joshua asks him, are you for us or for the enemy? He says, neither. But as commander of the Lord's host, I've now come to you. So whose side is the Lord on? Is he on Abraham's side and Sarah's side? No, the Lord is working his plan through Abraham. He's going to protect Abraham because it's his plan. And the same thing goes for us. It's like, well, I'm a Christian, so God is on my side. God, no, wait. You've been saved, to brought into God's plan because he's building a kingdom. Well, I need God to, no. God needs you to do this. God doesn't work for us. We work for him. Any one of us can be discarded, and the plan of God will continue. God is not going to abandon his plan on our behalf. Not for Joshua, not for Abraham, not for Abimelech. So it's just interesting right here. He's not out here defending, although he talks about being Abraham's shield. He talks about being our shield, protecting. But again, the idea here is God is working a plan, and we got to get on God's side and not always try to get God to be working for us. Then the Lord said to him in verse 6 in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience, and so I have kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. So, what was he trying to touch her? Was he trying to get to her? What was it? Now return the man's wife. Now watch this next line. For he is a prophet, and he will pray for you. Now this, we need to stop for a moment and look at this right here. Because right there, reading that, 20, whatever century are we in? Is it 21st century? Prophet, and he will pray for you. Now again, I do not want to add to the text or get off base, but I also don't want to just jump right into a prophet, for example, tells the future. He foretells, like Jeremiah foretold the future of Israel. Or John the Apostle wrote the book of Revelation. It's eschatologically. Abraham is a prophet. He's talking about eschatology. He's got prophecy conferences. He's probably got a very good insight on when the rapture is going to happen. It's like, okay, no, I don't. That's now you're reading something into the text. We got to keep it in the context of what it is. A prophet is someone that speaks for God. So Abraham is going to speak for God, and we can see that taking place. Again, you can think of New Testament prophet. Now, what's interesting is in the New Testament, in Joel, that was quoted by Peter, Joel prophesied it. All believers will prophesy. They'll all be in this category right here. Not everyone was a prophet, and not everyone today is, in a sense, in the church, is in the role of a prophet. But just kind of keep this in mind. What the prophets of this time, and this comes right out of the Ugaritic text, the ideas here, a prophet was someone who sat in the heavenly council with the gods. When the gods would meet, there'd be a prophet, a man that would be chosen that could also be there, and that they would hear what the decisions was made by the council, and then they would report it to the people, the nation, the kings. So the prophet would be part of this council. They would sit there. They would have a voice. This is important. They would have a prophet in the Ugaritic context here. And that's why Elohim tells Abimelech he is a prophet. And what Abimelech doesn't hear, I've got some end time questions for him. Or I need to know God's plan for my life. Can you like pray over me, have a little tongues interpretation and give me a prophecy? He's not thinking that. When the God, Elohim, says in the dream to Abimelech, Abraham is a prophet, it's like, holy smokes. He's saying in this culture, he's part of the heavenly council. He knows what we're doing, and he has a voice. He's like, whoa, 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 you're pushing it. You think, go back to chapter 18. In fact, I will go back to chapter 18. The three visitors, you know. Verse 16 of chapter 18, when the men got up to leave, they looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord, Yahweh is the word there, Yahweh said, shall I hide? Now listen, he just got done eating with Yahweh and two angels. When we say the gods that sit in the heavenly council, they're not gods, they're angels. There are no gods. There's heavenly creatures, heavenly beings, rulers and authorities in heavenly places. Humans, mankind calls them gods, little g, but under Yahweh, they're angels, or they're the sons of God. You can call them gods if you want to. The scriptures can refer to them as gods, but they're not like own separate identities of their own ruling universes. They're all under Yahweh. So you just got done having lunch, Abram just got done having lunch with Yahweh and two angels, quote, little g gods. And the two men, they appear as men, they go down towards Sodom. They're going to go investigate Sodom and destroy it. Then Yahweh, verse 17, said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Now, he's already met with the heavenly council. You can see this throughout Scripture. It's not just God sitting on his throne like he's Zeus sending bolts of lightning. He's having councils. There's from Job through the Psalms. You see him meeting with the heavenly councils. And here, they've decided, him and two angels, they've come down and they've already decided what to do. Shall I hide from Abram what I'm about to do? He says, Abram will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. So the Lord will bring about for Abram what he has promised. Then the Lord says, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. The men turned away toward Sodom, but Abram remained standing before Yahweh. Then Abram approached him and says, will you sweep away the righteous? And now you've got the whole conversation there of Abraham negotiating with the head of the heavenly council, sharing his voice and influence on the heavenly council, working it down to, we can find 10 righteous people. God, the Lord says, if we can find 10 righteous people, we'll spare the city. So Abraham is negotiating with the head of the heavenly council in chapter 19, or chapter 18. Does that make sense what I'm saying? So we go back to chapter 20, chapter 20, verse 7, and Abimelech is being says, now return the man's wife, in verse 7, chapter 20, verse 7, now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet. I want you to understand and think it this way, at least consider it. He is part of the heavenly council. He knows my plan, and he has a voice. He speaks my plan. He reveals my plan, and he's got a voice in the council. Besides that, now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and look at this next part, he will pray for you. He has a voice in the heavenly council. You give him his wife back, I'm happy, and now that prophet will use his voice in the heavenly council for you. He will pray. That's what it is. Pray. Who pray? What? Okay. Well, they were praying. I just asked that you'd bless the tulips and bless the little fishies. Just bless everyone in the world. I'm praying. Okay. That's cute. Pray would mean he'll bring his voice. When he speaks God's plan to you, he's speaking as a prophet. When he's praying for you, he's speaking as a prophet interceding for you in the heavenly council. It's like he'll bring his voice into the heavenly council for you. Now watch. I'm going to read this again. And he will pray for you. In the Hebrew, that phrase, he will, is a word that means, or it's written in a form. It means he may pray and you may live. It's like it's undetermined. It's like he may pray. He may pray. He may use his voice in the heavenly council. We don't know what the decision the heavenly council is going to be, but he may bring your petition to the heavenly council. And he's not in charge of the heavenly council. He can just petition the heavenly council. And perhaps we'll have a good... So now he's got some motivation. This pray is not just, you know, he'll bless the food. He'll actually intervene on your behalf. He's a prophet with the ability to intervene for you in the heavenly council. I would consider what you're doing. Give him his wife back. Maybe he'll use his voice in the heavenly council for your benefit. Now, and you say, well, that's a little exaggerated. Maybe, but let's look at the results a little exaggerated. He will pray for you and you will live, or he may pray for you and you may live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all yours will die. Now, you can see even in the NIV translation, he will pray for you and you will live. But I can tell you for sure, there's no maybe if he doesn't pray for you. If he doesn't pray for you and you don't return her, I guarantee you, you're all dead. Verse 8, early the next morning. I mean, he had the dream. He gets up, skips breakfast, doesn't brush his teeth. The next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials. Well, if he's summoning officials, he's probably going to brush his teeth. Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all of his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. He says, I just had a visit from Elohim, who says that Abram is a prophet sitting in the heavenly council with a voice, and we don't have his sister, we have his wife. Oh, no. He says, we've got to get her back. And they're like, yes, we do. What do we need to do? We've got to get her back. They don't just kick her out in the streets. They get out of here. They've got to restore. There's going to be several things they're going to have to take care of to get this thing back on track. And when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and says, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? Again, notice how the king, who I'm even willing to say this righteous king who's listening to God, realizes that his actions affect the nation. He does this, and God is threatening him with death, and he hears that as being, you're threatening my nation with death. And now he says, Abraham, you've done this thing to me. You've done this thing to my nation. We're connected even in the prophecy. Sometimes like the Nebuchadnezzar, the image of Nebuchadnezzar is the man Nebuchadnezzar, but sometimes that same image is the nation or the kingdom of Babylon. It's like you can't have, here's your ruler and here's the nation. They're the same thing. You destroy the ruler, you destroy the nation. You exalt the ruler, you exalt the nation. A ruler makes a bad decision, a ruler is corrupt, the whole nation comes down. It's like, well, that wasn't our fault. Listen, in the heavenly council, nations rise and fall with their leadership. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Especially in a democracy where you vote them into office. It's one thing when you get taken over, but it's another thing when you're like, yeah, let's do this. I mean... Okay, then Abimelech called Abraham in and says, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my nation, my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done. This is not how you do business. You don't put your wife on the market thinking we're going to make a treaty, because there's no way we can make a treaty. In other words, if we go back to that treaty idea, there's no way this was ever going to reach a conclusion. She was just bait on a hook that when it finally came time to make the deal, oh, we got to go. And he takes off with his wife. He's not going to give it. He's not going to bargain his wife off, but he is going to put her out there on display and think everyone, and again, not sexual display, but in display as, hey, here's an open contract. There's no open contract. But everyone's going to treat him like he's got something on the market. You have done things to me that should not be done. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what was your reason for doing this? Now here's Abraham explaining it himself. Abraham replied, I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because she is my wife. Now see, there that's like that open, what does that mean? There's no fear of God in this place, and so when they see my wife, they'll kill me. Now, you know, in what world does that make sense? You go into this place, this is not a godly place, I got my wife with me, they're going to kill me. Ah, I know how to get out of this. She's my sister. Okay, let's say I'm walking through the streets of Chicago. We did that a couple years ago. We went to the University of Chicago, the Museum of Institute. Remember, we do a lot of these things. We went to Jerusalem by ourselves and do a lot of things. So we're going to go down. And it was scarier than Israel. We take a train, kind of scary, down. We didn't know where we were going. We just know we're heading down here. We get off the train. It's like, oh, this isn't Kansas. And we start walking the streets. It's like, okay, well, we know where we're going. And it just got scarier and scarier. And pretty soon, there's people on the streets just kind of looking at me and Tony with my little backpack. I'm going to go take pictures at the University of Institute. And there's some police officers. It's like, that kind of like, it's like a stare down in the street. There's some police officers kind of staring down. Some guys, there's no children riding bikes. There's no women. It's just these guys all kind of stand around. And we're just going to the museum. It's right down this road. And I'm like, oh, what do I do? That's right, like Tony. Tony's like, I don't feel good. I will be fine. She's listening to me. No, okay, my whole point, I got to finish the story. But why am I telling the story? I didn't say, hey, this is not my wife. It's my sister. And everything just, oh, okay, well, come on. It's like it's like a dangerous situation. Not my wife, it's my sister. Oh, well then he's not a threat. Come on in. That would just draw an attention to myself. Anyway, we walked up, we're gonna go down and say, what are you guys doing here? There wasn't like a nice police officer either. It's like, I'm afraid of the situation. And the police officer, I think, you know. It's like, and he was like kind of mad at me too, thinking like, what kind of an idiot are you? And I said, we're gonna go to the museum, the University of Oriental Institute Museum. And he goes, now this way. What's this? He goes, I know where it's at. He says, go around. But there's like this, you know, like three or four blocks going this way. So it's like, okay, sir. And we walked, and Tony kept looking back, and everybody's kind of walk us, leave, go out of the neighborhood. But it's like, you know, who knows? I'm not sure what I was stepping into, but I was stepping into something. And but anyway, whole point, my first thought was like, oh, I bet you they think she's my wife if they find out she's my sister. I mean, but that in this mind right here, this is the king talking to the sheik, Abraham. He says, when I came into your city, I knew there's no fear of God here, so I knew that if you thought she was my sister, you wouldn't kill me. What? But we don't know exactly what that means. But it would make sense that if he's married, he's here, and we can't get anything from him legally, we'll just have to kill him and take his stuff or eliminate him. But if he's got a sister, whoa, he's on the market. We can start negotiating with him. Again, that's one look. Anyway, that he says that. This is surely no fear of God in this place. And of course, there was. And they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister. And here, this is the truth. She is my sister. He said this before. The daughter of my father. So this would be Terah's daughter, because that's Abraham's father. Though not of my mother. So him and Sarah have the same father, but they don't have the same mother. And that would be accurate, historically accurate. And she became my wife, and you know, would have negotiated, had the bride price. And again, what a great deal if you're Terah, because Abraham is going to have to pay the dowry for Sarah, so he's going to take the family money that he's built up and going to put it back into the family. Which again, it's like, well, that makes sense. They're not dispersing; they're just recycling the inheritance, the money. Now watch this next word. You got to watch this. This is interesting. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. Watch this next verse, verse 13. And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, this is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. We've got two situations, Egypt and now the Philistines. But this was the plan from the moment they left Ur. When they leave, they're breaking away from their family and they're out on their own. If everybody, I've got to be out here making contracts, treaties. I've got to be negotiating. I've got to be getting pasture lands. I've got to be open in the market. And if you're my wife, I'm going to be at a disadvantage. But if you'll tell everybody you're my sister, we'll play this all the way through the Middle East. We'll play it from Haran all the way down to Egypt through the, that you're my, and people think, well, hey, we can maybe get in on some of his property, get in on some of his possessions. This is now, here's the word. Here's the word. this is Abram's testimony to Abimelech. Remember, God called him out of Ur, and Abram's been faithful to the Lord. But the word he uses right here, and when God had me wander from my father's household, that word wander is the Hebrew word hithu, H-I-T-U. It comes from a word, the form comes from a word that means to err. It translates deceived, err, go astray, mislead, or seduce. It doesn't mean when God brought me out with a powerful, mighty hand and sent me on this direction. It means when I got misled, when I got distracted, when I was seduced, when I got lost, when I was out here wandering aimlessly with no apparent direction. Abraham blames God and Sarah. This word means to wander aimlessly and hopelessly. If you want to write this down, Isaiah 19:13 uses the same word. It's used several times in the Bible just for that very thing, to be deceived, to be in error. It's talking about, in Isaiah 19:13, it's talking about, it's a prophecy to the Egyptians about how their cornerstones, which are the leaders of their nation, have deceived them. It says, those who are the cornerstone of her tribes, Egypt's tribes, have led Egypt astray. They're saying, those who are your leaders, political leaders, they have led the tribes of Egypt astray. They're supposed to be your cornerstone, but they're not. That would be the New American Standard. The English Standard Version says, they have made Egypt stagger. So the word that he's using there, it means to be led astray, to be staring. When the Lord who made me stagger, who led me into air, who led me out into here to be led astray, says, and when God had made me wander, that's a very, very nice word, wander in the NIV. It could be when led astray. I got seduced. I got deceived. I was betrayed. From my father's household, I said to her, this is how you can show me your love. Show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. Now again, that kind of helps you understand. I don't know all that's going on here. Obviously, we got the account. But to have Abraham use a word like that, is he covering his tracks again? Hey, you got to cut me some slack here, brother, because, I mean, I'm following the Lord, and I get out here, and he cuts me off. I mean, we have famine. I'm down in the Negev trying to find land for my cattle. I mean, I'm just trying to make ends meet. I'm just trying to make it to the end of the month. I mean, I was trusting God, but it ain't working out. I mean, is this part of a sob story, or is this Abraham's faith in action? You understand? It's like, because you can see Abraham being drugged. And again, you can see yourself. You're going from point A. He who began a good work in you is going to finish it. Maybe you're going to have a time, maybe I'm going to have a time where I'm negotiating with Abimelech in the land of the Philistines saying, hey, if I tell them the truth, this ain't going to work out. So we're just going to just play this game right here. And all of a sudden I find God on the other side. It's like, well, what do you expect? I'm out here trying to make a living and things aren't working out. What am I going to do? Well, continue in faith. It's like, well, you failed in faith and now you're rejected. Well, God just keeps taking Abraham and just moving from faith to faith to faith, moving him along. So, I mean, it's just an interesting, I mean, we're reading this chapter 22. I mean, he's in the land of the Philistines, says his wife is his sister. She gets in the harem almost. The Lord intervenes with a dream. Now Abraham's trying to make excuses. Why is this story here? I mean, it's giving some glimpse into what's going on. It's got nothing to do. Why can't we just skip this story? I mean, we just got done reading that Sarah's going to have a son in a year. Well, now, while we're waiting for that year, we've got to hear about Sodom, how wicked that is, hear about the destruction of Sodom. Then we're going to have Abram going to have this situation in the land of the Philistines. We're not done yet. He's going to end up having to negotiate with him again over in Beersheba. So it's just kind of interesting. You see several things. One key thing in this chapter is the idea that he's a prophet. And that, I mean, God calls him a prophet. I mean, it wasn't that he was known by the people. God says he's a prophet, and that word prophet would mean, and you can see in chapter 19 that he's involved, chapter 18, he's involved in the heavenly council. God has taken Abraham's word. But then right here, he throws God under the bus. He made me wander. This is how you can show your love for me. Okay, now watch Abimelech. Abimelech has got, oh my gosh. There are four things. I'm going to write this very quickly. This explains. He's going to have to vindicate Sarah, that Sarah is innocent. He's going to have to reverse a bride price. Now, this explains what's about to happen. To take a bride, you'd have to pay, like if you're going to take a husband, a father's daughter, you'd have to return something to the father. You just didn't just, you know, I just took Tony, you know. I mean, it just, you know, I just married her. You know, it's like, then she's gone. Back in this day, it's like, no. You don't just take my daughter. Because, I mean, she's leaving. She's joining my family. I mean, she's coming into my corporation. It wasn't much of a corporation. But in this time, I mean, you'd have to pay a bride price to have the wife or the daughter switch from this family unit to this family unit. I mean, it's a trade. So that's two things that have to take place. This is probably very huge. Abram's prayer. I know his name's Abraham right now. Abraham's prayer is crucial. It's not just, okay, would you bless the food? It's like, would you go to the heavenly council and intercede for me? Because the opposite of a prayer would be a curse. A prophet, and you can see this in the Bible, a prophet can go to the heavenly council and say, I condemn these people. And the council, it's not like God's going to jump on it, but it's like, that's the prophecy. That's what Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's go down and see if the outcry is as bad as this. We've heard a call for a curse. Let's go check it out. Yeah, so heavenly council, I think we're good to go. Yeah, we're going to go with this. I mean, yeah, I know God is sovereign, but when you read the Bible, there's people praying. You're praying. There's people interceding. And then there's the council that's taking these things into consideration. And then, of course, God's making the final decision. But even the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, you're going to see nature destroy Sodom. You're going to see the Lord destroy Sodom. You're going to see the angels destroy Sodom. So what was it? Was it the angels? Was it the atmospheric blast? Was it the Lord? Well, the Lord used the angels to manifest an atmospheric solar blast. It's like, and yet it was someone down there complaining about the situation. So you got boots on the ground saying, this place is a hellhole. Well, someone looks up the ladder, it's like, the Lord says, well, let's go down and look at it. And the decision all the way up, it's like, so when it says Abraham is a prophet, it's like, oh, well, what do I need to do? I don't want to offend the prophet. I want him to give a good report. Otherwise, it would be a curse. Not just an empty curse, but it's like, my advice is that we take Sodom out. All right, well, you guys decide, and I'll see what happens. And then four would be appease Elohim. So this is where Abimelech finds himself. One, he's taken a woman with the intention of bringing her in, and he's got to somehow vindicate her that, oh, whoa, no, nothing happened. She's still good. There's nothing happened to her. Also, a reverse bride price. Just like you pay someone to bring her into your family, he's actually going to do the same thing, except I'm going to pay to put her back into your family. And the price is going to be 1,000 shekels, which doesn't mean anything yet. Abraham's prayer, which is crucial, and then appeasement to the God who appeared to him in a dream, I want him happy. I got to have Abraham pray for me because maybe he'll pray for me, maybe he won't. Maybe if he doesn't pray for me, maybe he's going to curse me. Oh, I don't want that going to the heavenly council. So I need Abraham, I need to appease Elohim, I need Abraham, and I need to pay the money to get her back into the right family, and nothing happened. So those are the four things that are taking place right here. I said to her, this is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere you go, we go, say of me, he is my brother. And this has been going on throughout the Middle East. Then verse 14, then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham. That's what Pharaoh did. I mean, does Abraham need more sheep, more cattle, more male and female slaves? What about slavery? Well, it's right. It's like there's a whole lot of things going on in here. And gave them to Abraham. Here, Abraham. And he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech says, my land is before you. Live wherever you like. We are not going to, there's no contract here. I'm giving you all this. I'm going to sign the contract and pay the price. And I want, and I'm going to give you your wife back. In fact, he's, you know, the kind of, I'll give you this. And they're probably being negotiating. It's like, okay, I'll pay full price and you can have your wife. And I'll get nothing. You just go whatever you want to go. The whole land is yours. Just keep moving through our land. We're good. Nothing. So he basically signs the contract, gives full price, but says, as far as paying me, just tears up his nose. You don't owe me anything. He's focusing on this right here. I need your prayer because Elohim says you're a prophet. This is not just him talking to another guy. This is him talking to the guy that Elohim says in a dream is a prophet. Don't piss him off. Sorry I said that. All right. It just was right there. To Sarah, he said, watch this. To Sarah, I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels. That is an exorbitant price. 1,000 shekels. You would work an entire year as a laborer for 10 shekels. He's paying 100 years of labor. Also, in the Ugaritic text, when the gods had a bride price, because the gods, little g gods, they'd be marrying back and forth. The bride price in the Ugaritic text was 1,000 shekels. And so he's paying to get her from his family back into the correct family. He's paying a godlike price for Sarah to go back to Abram. To Sarah, he says, I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels. I'm giving your brother. He doesn't say husband because you don't give the husband his wife back for 1,000 shekels, but you can take the wife, the sister, and put her back into the right family with her brother. Now, you decide what you are, but I'm giving the sister back to the brother because I took the sister from the brother. And here's 1,000 shekels. It should have been the other way around. He gives 1,000 shekels, and he gets her. I'm putting her back, and I'm still going to pay the bride price. He wants no, I mean, he's not just saying I'm innocent. He's going out of his way. This is to cover the offense against you before all who are with you and you are completely vindicated. Then Abraham, watch this. Then Abraham prayed to God, and God, now you get it. So Abraham, he gets this. She's vindicated. The bride goes back to the family. We're going to see Elohim is appeased. Because he's going to heal, and Abraham is going to pray. So he gets the prayer, and this takes place. Then Abraham prayed, number three, prayed to God, Elohim, and God, Elohim, healed Abimelech. So somehow Abimelech was afflicted. Now, they realized it because they're not having children. So, again, how do they realize this? I mean, we're still in a process of a year. I mean, it's got to be, it can't be like, it's been 4 years and none of my harem people are getting pregnant. I mean, it's got to be something more, you know, instantaneous. It's like something's wrong here. You can use your imagination. And God healed Abimelech, his wife. Something was wrong with his wife. And his slave girls. Now, his slave girls were being used for the similar thing that his wife was being used for, and his wife's got the same problem that the slave girls have, and he's got his own problems, so that they could have children again. So now they're back to reproducing. And again, we're not talking about 5 years of testing. We're talking about a few days, a few weeks. So again, your testing is going to involve a little bit shorter period than the, you know, 9-month process. For the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah. That's just an interesting story right there. It shows you some part of the culture. It shows you Abraham, Sarah's struggle. God's using them. They're the foundation of our faith. Abraham's the father of the three great faiths of the world. But here you have this story right here. And not going to say that he's corrupt. He's working the system. You got God on his side. But you've got a man. Who's the righteous man in this story? The righteous man in the story is the Philistine, Abimelech. He's the one who hears the dream, responds. And just interesting, seeing Abraham a prophet, Elohim listening, cooperating. Just a lot of interaction going on with that. And what's nice about that, again, this is not just a unique place in the Bible. You can see this type of activity throughout the Bible. This, you know, the rulers and authorities, the prayer, the cursing, God intervening in history. I'll pray and we're free to go. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would be people of God, that we would take you serious, that we would take the things that you have us doing in a serious manner, that we would consider your activity in our life to be something that's occurring daily, that we're not just randomly wandering, lost, being led in error, but you are working a plan in our lives and that we should trust you and continue to do the things that you've called us to do. Father, we do again thank you for this opportunity to live at this time in history, and thank you for the chance to be believers at this time with your word, your spirit, and the fellowship with other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.